Welcome to another episode of Residentially Speaking, a podcast dedicated to bringing you interesting and informative content from key builders, dealers, thought leaders, and influencers across the residential construction industry. I'm your host, Alan Hubble.
If you kind of imagine code is base level, Energy Star is an improvement on that. And then there are some financial incentives, both at the federal level and many local municipalities have further utility credits or other things that stack onto 45L savings and also are tied back to Energy Star.
Joining me on today's podcast, I have two members, colleagues from the DuPont team. We have Aaron Grin and William Ranson. Aaron works in our R&D group as a residential applications technology leader, and William is the leader of our Building Knowledge Center. Aaron's a Canadian professional engineer and building systems researcher with over 19 years of background in building science and structural engineering. Before joining DuPont a few years ago, he was an engineer for Building Science Corporation before moving over to RDH Building Science and Engineering, where he was a principal practice area leader of R&D. He's got tremendous knowledge and experience in building materials and systems, and has been involved with many root cause analysis of hundreds of infield forensic failures across all building types in North American climates. And then we also have, as I mentioned, William Ranson. William has nearly 25 years experience with DuPont, for the last 12 years leading our Building Knowledge Center, as I said, but prior to that, spent an awful lot of time in manufacturing, making Tyvek, both in the U.S. at our Richmond plant, as well as overseas in Luxembourg for a number of years. So comes to us with a great wealth of knowledge on the material side, material science side, and obviously on the application side as the leader of our Building Knowledge Center. So really pleased to have both of these folks join us for an in-depth discussion. So stay tuned and hope you enjoy the podcast. Residentially Speaking, that's coming up. William and Aaron, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you guys.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So the audience has heard a little bit about your background, but I thought maybe we would start there. You two are both incredibly experienced and knowledgeable, and we want to pick your brains and talk to you for the next 30, 40, 45 minutes or so. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about your background and let folks understand where you're coming from and what your experiences might have been. So as we get into the discussion, they have some sense of, you know, why should we believe you guys? So Aaron, why don't you start first? Give us a little bit about yourself and what might be interesting to the audience.
Sure. I'm a Canadian professional engineer. I have a master's in building science at Waterloo, and I've been working in the industry for almost 20 years. In my teenage years in university, I spent a lot of time pulling copper for installing fireplaces and just generally building things. After I got finished school, I kind of fell in love with building science and got a job at Building Science Corporation out of Boston. And over the years, I built myself up to be a principal at RDH Building Science, where I became the practice area leader for the research and development team. So I ran the research and development group there, which you may have heard of. They've written a lot of good papers, been involved with a lot of good research over the years.
Yeah.
And so my previous career was really split into consulting, forensics, and R&D. And then 2 years ago, I joined DuPont.
Yeah, it's great. No, we're great to have you. Let me ask you, what is a copper natural gas line? So I was thinking of natural gas is more of a flexible
pipe. Yeah, so it's flexible copper line. And that's typically what they run around to feed your barbecues or your fireplaces, your cooktops, things like that.
Okay. I did not know that was copper. So that's great, Aaron. Tell us a little bit now, a little more detail around what you're doing at DuPont. You've been here a couple of years. Yes. Proud to have you as a member of the team. And really enjoying our interactions. Tell us what you're doing within the DuPont business.
At DuPont, my official title, I guess, is the Residential Applications Technology Leader. Really what I'm looking at is how to use products on buildings, figuring out what products we need next, doing field exposure trials of those materials on a few different test facilities across North America. So I get to be in the office, I get to be in the laboratory, I get to be on construction sites. It's a pretty good gig.
Yeah, that's great. And you live in the Toronto area, is that right?
I live just west of Toronto, Ontario. Yes.
Okay, great. And spend a fair bit of time in the US though, with construction sites and so forth.
Yes. Yeah. It's a good time.
Great. No, great to have you. William, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? I had set you up as the Tyvek guy. You have a lot of experience in the material itself and manufacturing, but obviously lately in your career, a lot of application field experience.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. I do have 22 years experience, and it's been pretty evenly split between working in the plant, manufacturing Tyvek, or the technical support of Tyvek, and then the past decade around the high-performance building products that we sell. So for sure, well knowledgeable about Tyvek, but also extremely dangerous when it comes to styrofoam, Thermax, armor wall, great stuff, and really all of our high-performance products. Similar to Aaron, I also have a master's degree in engineering. Mine is focused on heat transfer. Funny enough, in college, my heat transfer focus was on gas turbine engines. Cool thing is, you know, physics is physics. So while the numbers aren't as large, it's still the exact same application for the building science that we work on.
Interesting. How about I know you're a wine guy, high performance wines as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, obviously the French know what they're doing, but Napa's pretty strong as well.
That's right. Yeah. That's a whole nother podcast we'll get into. So great. No, really pleased to have you guys. And I know, Aaron, I think you teach a little bit as well, or used to teach.
Yes, I do. I teach at University of Waterloo, and I teach about HVAC and indoor environmental systems, filtration, heating and cooling sources to architecture students. So it's a fourth year course.
Very cool. Yeah. William, you probably aspire to teach at your alma mater, right?
Easy killer.
Exactly. I like to go back and forth with William on his alma mater. That's great. Welcome, guys. So I really look forward to our discussion. I wanted to start with just kind of setting a baseline for what's happening in the industry, energy codes and standards. Obviously, we're at things are very fluid at the moment, right? With regulations in the U.S., new administration coming in, what might or might not happen or get changed. But in terms of where we are today, middle of February, what do we know about, you know, 2021 codes, 24 codes, Energy Star 3.2, zero energy ready home standard? What can you tell us to kind of level set the conversation in terms of where we are? I don't know who wants to start. Aaron, do you want to start with that?
Sure. I can probably give like a bit of a background too, because I don't know how many of our listeners kind of get the nuances of how things connect.
Yeah.
So the International Residential Code points to the International Energy Conservation Code, which really lists the thermal performance requirements for the enclosure. Both of these building codes, they're developed with incremental changes. There's small things, there's amendments that change every year or every 6 months. They get implemented as you go, but every now and then there is a much bigger change following like a five-year code cycle. So those are the ones we're looking at. And that's why we start talking about this in, you know, the 2025 code, the 2030 code, the 2035 code, because those are the ones that are usually big bites. You can akin this to other industries too, if you want. You know, every year there's an all new F-150. But it's pretty similar to last year, but about on an every 5 year rotation, they're going to make meaningful changes to it. So it seems like there's a lot of industries that do that, and that's how the building code works. When you look backwards a little bit, in my career, I've seen it look like a set of waves, and it goes with kind of buzzwords that you see throughout the industry, whether it's energy efficiency, sustainability, resiliency. Now we're on to embodied carbon and life cycle analysis. And when you take a step back and see that it's coming to embodied carbon and life cycle analysis now, it's kind of coming back around to energy efficiency, because those all kind of loop together again. So the other piece is that as the government moves forward with a bunch of these changes, it also depends what your local jurisdiction has adopted. So if you're in a jurisdiction that's working in a pre-2012 code or pre-2009 code, and all of a sudden you want to jump up to current Energy Star and 2021 plus, that's going to be a big jump. So you're going to see massive changes in how you need to build your building if you're going from an old code to current Energy Star to try and get some of the tax benefits that are coming.
That might accrue.
I guess are here.
Yeah. I love the car analogy. I'm just thinking, I have an old beater, 233,000 miles on an old SUV, and then I got my new car. And I love both of them. I'm comfortable in my old one, but there's certainly some features and benefits in my new car that I just don't, you know. You got to have, right? The rearview mirror, the backup camera and these kind of things and Bluetooth and whatnot. That's a really cool way of thinking about it. Every few years, there's a significant upgrade.
Yeah. And then every now and then there's like a complete restructuring of the F-150, right? Like they'll throw a wrench in it and say, we're going to go to an aluminum body. We're going to go to a smaller turbocharged engine. And those things happen in the building code too. And they're shockers to some people.
Yeah, for sure. That's cool. William, I know you've done a lot of work on Energy Star and trying to understand it. What would you add, and maybe in the Energy Star space?
Thanks, Alan. I think one thing that people are asking a lot of questions about, because unfortunately, some of the regulations are confusing. So maybe to try to help clear it up a little bit, furthering what Aaron shared about it, the code that's adopted in whatever state you are in, that's the law, that's the requirement for energy code. However, Energy Star is an optional program, and we certainly think it's a strong one, but it's an optional program to have a higher performing home. And then fairly recently with the Inflation Reduction Act, there are now financial benefits to going to this optional program in the terms of tax credits to the builder, you know, specifically $2,500 tax credit for builders who meet a certain level of Energy Star. So again, it's, if you kind of imagine code is base level, Energy Star is an improvement on that. And then there are some financial incentives, both at the federal level and many local municipalities have further utility credits or other things that stack onto 45L savings and also are tied back to Energy Star. So they are optional, but they are very much intertwined as well. And I think we're going to start to get into some of those details on the specific requirements.
Yeah. So there's Energy Star, there's different versions for different states, right? Because it's relative, somewhat, they don't want Energy Star to be below the building code. So you might have a Energy Star version in one state that's different than Energy Star in another state, right? There might be some differences between them. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's correct. So today, if you look at, there's a handful of states that are moving on to Energy Star version 3.2. Specifically, if you're looking at Connecticut, Florida, Maryland, New Jersey, Vermont, Oregon, Washington, and then Illinois and Virginia sometime in 2026 are also moving to that. So Energy Star 3.2 is required for Energy Star certification, as well as being required for the 45L, the tax credit, the $2,500 I mentioned. All the other states outside of California, because we know California, they have their own thing, but it's not that dissimilar. But all the other states, while they still have Energy Star 3.2 required for the tax credit, all those other states, I guess it's 40-ish, require Energy Star version 3.1.
To be Energy Star certified, yeah. Yeah, thanks for that. It's a little confusing for folks. So correct. I guess if you're correct. A builder in those states, you know your Energy Star. If you want the credit, you got to build 3.2. If you don't want the credit, you got to build to whatever your state requirement is, well, requirement. Your state standard is for Energy Star.
In the states that I just rattled off, they're on the way. They haven't been updated yet. I was just going to mention the states that I just rattled off. If people want to see specifically their state, the energystar.gov website has an updated map of which states have which version of Energy Star requirement.
Great, yeah. And Aaron, sorry, you were saying the next version's coming.
Right, I think, isn't California into 3.4 already?
I think so. They start to add some digits, I think, 3.2.1 or 3.2. Yeah, it gets, California's pushing. I think Hawaii kind of pushes it too. They're a little bit different than some of the other states.
But, yeah, and I think one of the takeaways that you have to realize jumping to Energy Star off of the IECC is the air tightness requirements.
Yeah, tell us about that a little bit.
There's a range of air tightness requirements. I don't know if William has them in front of him there for 3.2. Basically, the colder you get, the more airtight you need to be. And the air tightness requirements aren't in the IECC or the IRC. But if you want to sell Energy Star, you got to get lower door tests done.
Okay. If you're...
Yeah.
Go ahead, William.
Aaron, as always, is correct. If you go back to Energy Star version 3.1, you're looking at 4 air changes per hour in climate zones 1 and 2, 3 air changes per hour in all the other climate zones. When you move up to Energy Star version 3.2, it's 3 air changes per hour across the board, regardless of climate zone. And we had talked before about, you know, the newer version 3.3 coming out, and I'm pulling up that number right now. Yeah, it's 3 across the board, except for the colder climate zones 6, 7, and 8, where now it's dropping down to 2.5. So each Energy Star level is increasing the amount of air sealing you need around a house, which again is a perfect alignment of high performance building, controlling or minimizing the air leakage you have across your envelope. So if you can control and insulate the space well, you can optimize your energy savings, you know, with good mechanical systems.
Yeah, for sure. So that's air tightness. Before we go to thermal, let me just ask, so the zero energy ready home standard, how is that different than the Energy Star? I don't know who wants to take that, but what does that, what does it entail to get from an Energy Star to a zero energy ready home?
Sure. So to be zero energy ready, first, you already do need to meet the Energy Star requirements. And then there's some additional add-on features, some not as relevant to what we're talking about today in the envelope, things to make sure the house is ready for electrification. But another key one is the air leakage rates are also lowered even more. So for the DOE zero energy ready home and climate zones one and two, you're looking at 2.75 air changes per hour. Climate zones 3, 4A and 4B, it's 2.25. 4C, 5, 6, and 7 climate zones, it's 2 air changes per hour. And climate zone 8, so the very coldest in the U.S., 1.5 air changes per hour. So they're really driving down the air leakage rate you can have for a zero energy ready home, which makes sense because the less leakage you have, the less energy you're going to use on your mechanicals, heating and cooling that air. And additionally, related to air leakage, you also, to be zero energy ready, you need to be EPA indoor air plus certified. That's part of the zero energy ready program, which again, is very hard to accomplish without having a good, tight air barrier envelope on your house.
Yeah, starts there. Yeah. And Aaron, you were going to say something. I think we cut you off. You're going to comment more on the air tightness.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that the installation, there are grades of installation, but it's really a qualitative review. Like either the insulation is there or it's not. And it's obvious if it's there. Air tightness is a totally different animal because unless you measure it, you have no idea if you've met the target. So it all has to be measured. And it's a definite pass fail. Like if you are 2.52 air changes per hour and you're supposed to be 2.5, you need to do something, you need to fix it. And so some of the best ways to think about that is thinking about the air barrier, the details around it, but also developing a system that the air barrier is exposed when you test it so that you can fix it if you don't pass.
Right, right. And do you recommend that folks, obviously once they build, they know how to get to those numbers, but is it a best practice to, would you test more than once? You might test at some stage of construction, kind of understand where you might need to be at that stage and then come in for a final later. So you do have the ability to fix something.
In programs like Passive House, that is very typical. The air barrier will be installed. It'll be affixed. It'll be sealed. It'll be integrated. You'll do usually there's like 3 tests that they do to get to the final one because the requirements are so low at 0.6 air changes per hour. Most consultants will actually aim that before everything's buttoned up, you're in like the 0.4 to 0.5 ACH that you know when everything's done, you're definitely going to hit the 0.6 because it's 100% pass or fail. And you just spent thousands of dollars on extra materials and consultants and all sorts of stuff that you better pass.
Right. And we've had, William knows this gentleman, we've had Jorgen Young on from Isola in Norway, where the code is passive house, 0.6 air change in terms of air changes. 0.6, and they're building, you know, Tyvek has a very nice business in Norway, large share. And to your point, Aaron, they're able to detail the exterior, you know, water air barrier. They have to do some things on the inside, of course, too, but they can get pretty low with just exterior detailing down in the low ones, if my memory serves me correct, and then the rest of the way with the interior sealing practices. So we've talked about the IRA. I guess before we move on, I want to cover thermal. You mentioned insulation, installation. But tell me a little bit about the thermal requirements in either the codes, IECC 2021, 24, and or Energy Star and Zero Energy Ready. What's that progression look like?
So how about I can start with talking a little bit about Energy Star, but then Aaron, I'll throw it over to you to talk about codes because that'll be a more lengthy discussion as you have options on which path you take, you know, performance or prescriptive wise. So starting back at a high level, again, Energy Star version 3.1, the insulation requirements are supposed to be modeled to the 2012 IECC codes. So, you know, older set of codes, but depending on state adoption, that could be essentially the existing code adoption in the state you're in. Moving up to Energy Star version 3.2, it takes a pretty big jump. Or now the insulation needs to be modeled to the 2021 codes, which is a lot more emphasis on continuous exterior insulation. And interestingly enough, if you go to look at what the future that's coming in terms of version 3.3, it's starting to be much more prescriptive in terms of essentially for climate zones 4 and higher, you pretty much have to have continuous exterior insulation to meet those program requirements.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big change. And in the codes, as you mentioned, Aaron, so there's a in the energy codes, there's a few more options, right?
Right, exactly. So when you're looking at future targets, 2030 code is really current net zero ready, right? Like that's where it's going. And I think the easiest way to think about future codes, like if you're trying to future proof your construction and figure out what you should be building in 5 years or 10 years, if you want to know what you should be building in 5 years, you can probably just look at the next climate zone. So if you're building in 2, look at the requirements for 3, because that's kind of what's coming down the pipe. If you're building in 4, look at the requirements for 5. If you're going to want to build to net zero, or you're trying to build a 10-year business plan, look 2 climate zones up. And that's really what you're going to have to be doing. And they're already starting to have ideas in there about implementing code required, even in the IRC, air tightness requirements that look like the ENERGY STAR requirements. Yeah. So that's all kind of trickling down. So look at the higher performance buildings that people are building today. That's what you're going to be building in 5 and 10 years.
Yeah, that's a really cool way to look at it. One climate zone up for ENERGY STAR or 21 code, and then two climate zones up if you're trying to perform to even higher level.
Right.
And so folks will say, well, I'll just do it when I need to. I'll wait right. 5 years or 6 years. That's a common pushback you hear. What would be your response to that? What would be your reason for jumping in now and making some changes?
I think there's other considerations for sure. Like for me personally, there's global carbon emissions impact. And I know a variety of places have signed on to the COP and IPCC carbon reduction requirements. And really electrification is the only way to get there. But to electrify your building, especially in a colder climate, you need to either reduce the size of the building or make it higher performance. To make it higher performance and use electrified heat pumps, you have to be building better than we are today. You can't build a base code house. You can't really even build an ENERGY STAR house unless you put in, you know, multiple heat pumps. It's fantastic technology out there, but what we think we really need to be doing is designing our buildings to meet the capabilities of the mechanical systems we already have. Don't build bigger mechanical systems because you can do it with what we have today if you build the right enclosure.
Yeah, right. And just as an aside, folks can go check out our Education Hub website. We've done some webinars on electrification with Steve Easley where we've talked about that. Yeah, you got to get the enclosure right as you start to introduce these other mechanical systems, if you will, or the enclosure effects are going to overwhelm the systems, right?
Right.
William, you were going to say something?
Alan, I would add on to Aaron's answer as well. If builders who are thinking of perhaps waiting for the codes to catch up to them, is you're going to get left behind by your competition. We're seeing lots of not just smaller regional, but national home builders are signing up to go ENERGY STAR 3.2, are starting to look at how they can get to net zero homes. So they are producing very energy efficient homes, and they're learning how to do this very cost effectively. So if someone's waiting and doing code minimum, they're quickly going to see superior products being put out on the marketplace, and home buyers are becoming much more discerning. I think COVID has taught people to really think about the quality of the air they're breathing in their house, which again comes back to air barrier and ventilation, as well as their electric bills that they see every month.
Yeah. No, it's a great point, William. Yeah. Reason to jump in now and learn. We would also say, make a change or 2 or 3, run it for 6-8 months, assess where you're at, and add another change on top of that and another one and so forth, right? You don't have to do all of this at once, but you ought to be moving in that direction so that when you see your competition there, you're not either at even with ahead, but certainly not 3 or 4 or 5 steps behind. So Aaron, I think you were going to add on to William's comment there.
Right. And it's a great comment. And I think for the size of the builder, it matters as well. When we start talking about these national builders, when you start looking at really high performance buildings, it comes down to everything, even to siting, subplan, development, orientation of the homes, orientation of glass, orientation of the roof so that you can put solar on it. So it goes back to your subdivision planning. And that starts 5-7 years before you're putting houses on it and applying for permits. And for the smaller people who are building on a fixed lot, you have to have your permits in far enough ahead, and the permits have to have all these things on them. Mm. And so if you're trying to meet the 2030 code, you're planning it in 2028. So you have to wrap your head around it now so that you understand it by then. And now is, like you said, you should be trialing a few of these things. You should be doing blower door tests, finding out how airtight your building is. Right. You should be figuring out how to install exterior insulation, whether it's 1, 2, 3 inches of it. How do we do this? Do we train our trades? Do we have specialists on site? Do we have our very special air tightness guru who runs around and fixes everybody else's holes?
Right. Yeah, I think the trade, the implications and the effect on the trade and the trade on being able to build this way, like we could do a whole podcast on that. Matter of fact, we're going to do a lot of work. I have a number of presentations at the upcoming IBS to talk about just that. That could be a whole podcast on itself, the what this means for the trades. So let's, I wanted to get to then, so we've kind of laid the groundwork of what Energy Star is, the energy codes, why you ought to be building this way, what's coming. I want to talk a little bit now about how do you meet them. You know, there's any number of ways, prescriptive methods. You can do some modeling. You can look at this UA calculation, which is where I want to get to eventually. But maybe one of you could walk us through what are the ways, quote, to meet these codes, as I said, the prescriptive and performance modeling. Can you tell us a little bit about those? Because that's where you get down to where the rubber meets the road. How are you going to do it, right?
Sure. I'll take a hit at that and see if Willie wants to jump in. The prescriptive paths, it's really two paths in itself. It's the R value path that we talked about and the U value path that we talked about. The R value path is literally a table, a list of numbers that says you must install these levels of insulation in your wall system. And it'll list, say, you need to put in R49 in your roof system. For the above grade walls and below grade walls, it'll tell you you need to use R13 and zero insulation, exterior insulation, or you need to use R13 and 5 on the outside. And at each phase, there's little nuances to it. Like in climate zone 3, it says you can put R20 bat in the wall, so you need to do 2x6. You could do R13 in the wall with 1 inch of extruded polystyrene on the outside of it, or you can do 3 inches of extruded polystyrene and nothing in the base. Hmm. So there's trade-offs, 2x4 versus 2x6. That's where it kind of lands you in terms of the above grade wall system. For the roof systems, because they've increased the requirements now in terms of R value, if you're building cathedralized roofs in, say, climate zone 2, which a bunch of the buildings are, currently you could do it with an R28 bat, and that fits into a 2x8 frame. The next requirement here is R49. So if you have to do R49, now that's a 14-inch TJI that you have to switch to. So it changes all of your roof framing plans. It changes your overhangs, the look of your eaves, all sorts of implications when you try to make that change. That's the R value path. The U value path is pretty similar, except U value is the inverse of R value. So R value is the resistance to heat flow. So the higher the number, the better. U value is the maximum allowable heat transmittance. So it's the heat flow. So the lower number is better. So low U values are better. Higher R values are better. And so to give you both tables, the U value table, they threw in a couple twists. If you just did the R values inverted to look at the U values, they don't line up, because in the U value table, it's the assembly U value, which means you can put on the air films on the inside and outside. You can count for the gypsum. You can account for the sheathing. So it adds up a little bit differently. Just two different paths, but they're both prescriptive. It said you must meet these numbers.
I was going to add, and the one benefit of looking at U values instead of R values that are simply following numbers in a table is the UA method, the looking at the U values, allows you to do some trade-offs. So if you're building a home with lots of windows on a wall, for example, that you might have to change some things to get the same energy efficiency as a home with less windows. Or you could look at, you know, are you building 16 on center or 24 on center? It allows you some trade-offs to optimize specifically what you're doing, or some things that just don't directly fit in the tables. Another example we like to highlight a lot is our friends down in Texas, like in climate zone 2, the prescriptive tables are either, you know, all bat insulation in the cavity, or the next option is R5, which is an inch of styrofoam on the outside. We know there are, of course, great benefits to continuous exterior insulation, but climate zone 2 in Texas, you know, an R3 on the outside helps a lot with reducing, you know, thermal losses through the framing members, but that doesn't show up exactly in the prescriptive tables. But in the UA option, you can take credit for that and potentially reduce some costs in other places for your thermal envelope.
Yeah. And Aaron, you were going to add to that.
Yeah. And I think William's jumping right to the UA method. The piece I was describing there was the R value table and the U value table. They're both kind of the prescriptive one.
Okay.
And the UA method that William's moving to is a separate path again. So there's the R value path, the U value path, then there's a performance path, which is the modeling where you hire somebody to go through your building with you. You include all the mechanical systems, sometimes air leakage, and there's trade-offs in that one as well. But it's all computer run. It estimates your energy versus the code required energy based on the two enclosures. But that one doesn't allow you as much flexibility to move things around in the assembly. That third one that William was talking about is the UA alternative path. It's a single bullet line that's down below the tables, and a number of people don't know about it. But it's, in my mind, probably one of the most flexible, and it really meets the overall goals that we have in terms of the building code, government, energy efficiency, the IPCC. Because what we're really trying to do is limit the amount of energy that's leaving the assembly.
Right.
You know, how you make it up with mechanical after that, those mechanical things, they're going to be changed. They're going to be worn out. They're going to be switched. They're going to be upgraded. Some of them can just be turned on. Like I've seen projects where you put in an HRV and they just turn it off, right? Like, so now it's not even being used. The UA method, to break it down, like William was saying, is instead of looking at the prescriptive U value or R value for a given assembly, you look at the U value for each part of each assembly and the area of each part of each assembly. And because the U value is the heat flow, if you multiply all those things together, you know, the area of windows times the U value of the windows, the U value of the walls times the area of the walls, the roof, the slab, you can calculate the overall heat loss of the building. Yeah. And then you just show that that's less than any one of the other paths that are available. And you meet the intent of the code for that. So it allows you to say, like William was saying, I want more glass. Like I want to have 25% glass in this house. Okay. So you're losing a bunch of energy through your glass. Maybe you need to put on an R60 roof to make up for it. And this path through the code allows you to do that. The performance path does a little bit, but it requires modeling iterations every time. This you can just pretty quickly play with because it doesn't involve all the mechanicals and air leakage. It's simply the thermal loss through the enclosure. And then if you're meeting Energy Star and doing UA, Energy Star takes care of the airtightness. The UA method takes care of a really good enclosure. So you can build almost whatever you want as long as it meets the heat loss of other things.
Yeah, that's really powerful and flexible. How's a builder, do you know, how would they, do they submit that at the time they request their permit? So it's a drawing and some of the engineers going to check it, make sure it makes sense and hangs in there and so forth. Yeah. Because a code official can't, like today on the prescriptive, they can go inspect, okay, 2x4, you got R13 in the cavities everywhere, good insulation, blah, 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 right? So it's a little more esoteric, I guess. I'm not sure where the right word is, but somebody has to go check the calculation, I guess.
Right. And sometimes you can use it as a tool to figure out what you should be building, because once you know those components, it's pretty easy to do a cost analysis off that. You can say, we're not going to do 14-inch TJIs in the roof. We're going to stick with our 2x8s and we're going to use this on the wall. We're going to do 2x4 or 2x6 with an inch of continuous insulation. And, you know, you can use your standard windows. Whereas in other instances, you may have to, looking at the prescriptive tables, upgrade your roof, upgrade your windows, keep your standard walls. So it's always been kind of interesting to me looking at the building codes that you need R49 in your roof or R13 in your walls, and you can put in R3 windows. Yep. In my mind, it makes sense to balance it out a little bit. Like, let's do R30 roof, R20 walls, and like R5 windows, right?
Right.
Bring in some balance.
Sure.
And Aaron, I think you highlighted something that I hope everybody really caught, but while there are a lot of options in the performance path, you know, the modeling of the whole house energy use is a valuable tool I for sure, you know, think going down the prescriptive or the UA option is a much better option because it separates optimizing your thermal envelope, something that likely isn't going to change from the life of the building. It separates optimizing that from optimizing your mechanicals, which, as you mentioned, are going to get changed and likely upgraded numerous times over the life of that building. So modeling the whole home, while it does allow you to trade off more efficient heat pump for maybe less efficient windows, you know, conceptually that doesn't make as much sense to me versus you want to minimize how much heat you're losing from the house, step one. And then step two, using that and your air leakage that you've measured, then optimize your mechanicals.
Yeah, and I think there's a big piece of future proofing here too, because as you go forward, your building enclosure, like you said, is never going to change. It gives you the opportunity to use higher performance mechanicals in the future that are going to use less energy, because the cost of energy is going to keep going up. It just will. So you're future proofing the building in terms of cost.
Yeah, for sure. So let me just take a moment here for a shameless promotion, and that is, both Aaron and William's team have the capability to run this UA calculation, and maybe we'll go to some examples next. But if you're listening to this podcast and you want to discuss this topic and maybe dive in and look at some options, we're happy to walk you through that. Just to reach out to DuPont and ask to do that. And one of these gentlemen would be happy to get on a call with you and present some of these options. It's really interesting because it allows you, like Aaron, you were saying, you trade off, okay, the cost, the materials and labor to maybe add exterior insulation, but I'm comparing that to a roof joist. Like, who would have thought, yes, right? And more insulation, right? Obvious, but a roof joist may be required, a raise, something. And that may not be so intuitively obvious. So you can play the games in the spreadsheet. You can play with the calculation and move things around, get that same UA or better, and assess your options. So anyway, just shameless promotion. We're happy to do that with you and for you. At least present it so you can then go work with your design teams and get you close. So you guys want to talk about some examples here, how this might manifest itself and how somebody might build?
Sure. That example that I wrote or mentioned earlier of R49 in the roof was a real project that we worked on. The client came to us and they were moving from R28 roofs, and they were required to meet Energy Star 3.2 now, and they're going to R49 roofs. And they're currently building, you know, well-framed, advanced frame 2x4 walls. All of their stuff is cathedralized. They use relatively expensive insulation in their roof systems. So to go to a much deeper roof system is very costly.
Yeah.
It changes all of their designs and it requires re-engineering of all of those systems. And what we figured out, and they also had to upgrade their windows. And they work with a range of window suppliers, so that's also complicated. What we figured out through using the UA method was that they can keep their standard framing package, 2x8 in the roof, 2x4 in the wall, and they can keep their standard window packages. And the only change, and this is going to kind of sound like a shameless plug too, they add an inch of XPS. And that basically solved all their problems.
So let me just hang there for a second. So if they hadn't have done that, I mean, the inverse is what you're... If they hadn't have added the 1-inch exterior insulation, they would have had to go change those other systems, which is significant cost, right?
Yeah. Right. So they would have had their standard wall package. They would have had to reframe, rechange, re-engineer all their roof systems, change their overhangs and cutoffs and fascia sizes, and talk to their window suppliers and strong arm them into making or giving them better windows.
Yeah. Triple glaze or something like that.
Yeah, not quite triple glazed for climate zone 2, but that is one of the trade-offs once you get into 4 and 5.
Yeah. So can you walk us through like an example, maybe with some elements that may or may not change and what some of the, I call them trade-offs, but some of the options?
So if we look at an older building code building in climate zone 2, you'd typically be running 2x4, R13 bats, an R28 or R29 roof system. You'd have pretty standard wall framing ratios, a U value in your windows of about 0.45, depending on the design and depending on the builder, something like 15 to 17% window to wall ratio. And that's probably what you've been building for 10 years or more.
And where does that get you in a UA? No. So where do you have to be? I guess that
fail.
That would be
it does not pass.
It does not pass what standard, what code?
2021 IECC.
Okay.
Which you would need to be competing in the Energy Star world, like William mentioned.
Right.
If you simply take all of those same assemblies and add on an inch of XPS, you get there.
Okay. Without an inch of XPS, what would you have to, what would you be looking to change?
Well, there's other options to get there. It would be to go to a deeper roof and improved windows. So we'd have to go to that R49-ish roof and go from a 0.45 window to a 0.4. So you'd have to get better windows and a thicker roof if you want to stick with no exterior insulation.
Okay. And there's obviously costs and changes and
right.
the design so then, involved with that.
Right. So if we want to look at a similar type example in Climate Zone 3, we don't need to model the old code. It won't pass.
Okay.
But in Climate Zone 3, you're typically being pushed to use either 2x4 plus an inch or 2x6. So where are you? What are your costs? Because you need to go to 2x6, you're going to be putting in R22 bats. You're going to need to move to an R49 roof. Instead of the 0.45 or 0.4 windows, they're going to be 0.3. So all of that adds up pretty quick, yeah. right? In terms of costs. Alternatively, you could do a 2x4 frame package. 1 inch of CI, the same windows and the same roof. So your framing package plus CI, it evens out the assembly better. You end up with a safer wall enclosure. The framing packages are lighter and cheaper at 2x4. And I believe there'd be a pretty close trade-off between the framing package adjustment and using CI. Yeah. And you're going to get a much more durable building using a CI. And there's all sorts of comfort benefits we can talk about with that and thermal bridging and condensation. But that optimizes that assembly. And if you want to go to a thinner roof system, you need to improve the windows again. So you can do 2x4 with an inch of insulation, but trade off an R35 roof. So instead of R49, go to R35, but you need to tweak the windows a bit. And this is, you know, all estimates based on these window to wall ratios.
Sure.
That,
yeah, right.
That I'm pretty comfortable with in terms of overall averages. And I should mention that almost all this modeling that we did and looked at it is a roughly 2,400 square foot, two-story rectangular shaped building with a moderate orientation. So not really stressing it, but not also, you know, giving it a pass.
You're not gaming this. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah,
so those get us up to Climate Zone 3, 4, 5. And like I said, you just keep incrementing this up. Like in Climate Zone 4, obviously current stuff won't pass the new code. That's, you know, the increments. But you'd have to be in that 2x6 plus an inch. I've heard some people talking about going to 2x8s instead of going 2x6 plus an inch. And that to me seems like it could be incrementally expensive because the smaller the framing member, the per volume price is lower because you can make it out of smaller trees. So it's not like it's a linear transition. Yeah, 2x8 is twice the price of a 2x4. It's like 3 times the price, 4 times the price.
Yeah, right. Right.
So there's little nuances to think about with that. But then again, you're going to have to improve the windows. You might have to get down into a 0.25 window, which is still playing in like a really good double glazed window.
Yeah.
And then there's that gear change when you switch to triple glazed windows. It allows you to back off on the roof, but now you have to buy and install triple glazed windows.
Right. Can be quite pricey. One thing, so just to bring it home, one of the ways this works is because there's so much area, surface area on a wall, on the wall, the four walls versus the roof, right? You end up with diminishing returns by adding more insulation to the roof, 1200 square feet, 1500 square feet versus 3000, maybe plus on the wall area. A little bit of change on the wall is worth a lot of change on the roof. In terms of thermal right. losses.
It's compounds from, as you said, not only the wall area being significantly larger, but when you look at the fact of a typical framed wall is 20 to 25% studs by area, now you're talking the large majority of your surface area, up to a quarter of that is, you know, R2 because of the high conductivity of your wood studs. And that's why the math always seems to work out and why the codes are continuing to enforce the benefits of continuous exterior insulation. I mean, we really see it as an easy button because you're significantly reducing those thermal bridging losses that
are really hard to get around otherwise.
Yeah. It's a big lever on the walls, right? Of R5 there, you take, you know, what does that R5 have to be on something that's one third of the area? It's got to be R15 or more, right? So that's kind of the leverage. Aaron, you're going to say some?
Yeah, sure. I think it goes to other alternative assemblies. So some people look at like closed cell spray foam as an option. So you do 2x6, you do a 2-inch pass of closed cell spray foam, and then an R13 bat inside that. That doesn't fix what William is talking about with the thermal bridging. So the higher R value of the material between the studs, the bigger the loss you're going to see. The studs will always be like a 25%-ish reduction of like an R20 bat.
Yeah.
So you put R20 bat between the studs and it's going to work like R15. If you put 1 inch of R5 on the outside, it's going to act like R5.
R5, right.
Right. And an inch of spray foam is pretty similar to the cost of an inch of XPS. So why don't you put it on the outside instead of in the stud bays
and get the full and benefit.
Get the full benefit of it.
Yeah, that's great. How does, and then maybe we'll close here. How does air leakage play into the UA calculation? Does it play in at all, or is that more prescriptive?
Correct. Air leakage is in the prescriptive pieces of Energy Star in 3.1 and 3.2, like the values William was talking about. The UA calculation is like the conductive heat loss through the enclosure. Air leakage isn't in the UA calculator. So we can't pull that lever. We can't play that game.
Okay.
Right. But if you're doing the UA calculator and Energy Star, you've got both.
You got them. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's great. Really enjoyed the UA discussion. It's so powerful and flexible at the same time. Right. And let you see those options. I want to call them. They're not trade-offs because you're not trading off performance. You're just different pathways to get different options and assemblies to get there. Anything we didn't talk about before we close that you guys want to mention?
I don't think so. I think it's been a great discussion.
I would only add, Alan, as another shameless plug, the role that I have now in DuPont is leading our Building Knowledge Center, and that's our technical marketing team and field support team. And as we did mention earlier, our team is here to help with doing some of these UA analyses. But another large part we do is training on people who do make the decision. Okay, now I do want to now put an inch of styrofoam on the outside. I've never done it before. What do I do? That's another service we offer to help make that transition for you. And we've seen plenty of times being out there with the actual, you know, be it the framers or builders or whoever is actually putting the product up, it doesn't take long for them to get really comfortable with building homes that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point, William. We not only do we have the building science, we can help get you there. And then we also have the ability to help execute it in the field through our specialist network and so forth and do the training and ensure that it gets on the wall properly. That's a great point. So yeah, with that, I think we'll thank both of you and close. And we look forward to hearing from our listeners again, if they want a UA discussion. A little more specificity to their situation. We're happy to do that. Reach out and contact us through the website and make sure you put UA somewhere in the comments or the subject, and we'll be sure to follow up with you. So with that, we'll close. We thank Aaron and William for their time and sharing their knowledge with us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by DuPont Performance Building Solutions, who provides the marketplace with a full suite of weatherization, thermal, and air sealing solutions, such as DuPont Tyvek wraps, flashings, and tapes, DuPont Styrofoam brand XPS rigid foam board, and Great Stuff and Froth Pack spray foams. DuPont knows the homes you build today will need to stand the test of time, expanding, contracting, breathing, and protecting for generations to come. Be sure to check back often for new episodes. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Alan Hubble, and residentially speaking, that's a wrap.